Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel. Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Monday, 10th of April, these are our main stories. There's growing hope over talks to end Yemen's devastating war. A boat with some 400 migrants on board is adrift and taking on water in the central Mediterranean. And South Korea says it will talk to Washington to clarify reports that US intelligence intercepted a confidential communication. Also in this podcast...
When I wrote somewhere that I had peered into hell, I think hell would be paradise compared to what I saw.
Tributes are paid to Benjamin Ferenc, the last surviving prosecutor from the Nuremberg trials after World War II, who's died aged 103. The news from Yemen needs to be treated with some caution. There have been plenty of false dawns before, but it seems the major players in the country's civil war are sitting down for peace talks. There has been a ceasefire in Yemen for the past year, but the hope now is that this can be made permanent and not a moment too soon. The United Nations estimates more than 200,000 people have died since fighting broke out in 2014. More than half of these died from indirect causes, lack of medicine, lack of food, a plight reported on for many years by the journalist Iona Craig.
The number of people in Yemen in need of humanitarian aid is still huge. It's over 21 million. It's slightly down from what it was previously, which was 23.4 million. But it's still more than 70% of the population in Yemen is in need of humanitarian aid. And more than 80% who struggle to get access to food, safe drinking water and healthcare. So the figures are still huge. One of the biggest problems now is the shortfall in funding. So the UN, even in February of this year, was looking to raise $4.3 billion for funding in Yemen and was only able to raise $1.2 billion. And that's the second year in a row where figures have fell short in that way. So it is an issue in Yemen now. The humanitarian crisis has eased a little bit, but it's still a long, long way from being an easy route for Yemenis to be able to access basic needs. I mean, nearly 90% of the population doesn't even have access to publicly supplied electricity. So it's basic infrastructure as well that makes life so difficult for the Yemeni population.
Iona Craig. So what chance then that a lasting peace can be established in Yemen so that work can begin to ameliorate those dreadful problems? Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, told me why people are more optimistic now than when previous efforts were made.
We've seen a Saudi delegation and an Omani delegation. The Omanis have played a mediating role for some time over Yemen, arriving in the capital Sana'a, which is controlled by the Houthis. They've controlled it since they forced the government out 8 years ago, and that was the trigger for the war that has carried on ever since. And the mood music is good. I mean, unnamed sources, nobody's gone on the record about it, but very much talking it up. Talking up at least in terms of a ceasefire deal being achieved and one that would be longer than the short-term temporary ceasefires that were agreed last year and that expired. Potentially, as you were saying, a permanent ceasefire.
Feels like we've heard an awful lot of times about peace efforts, the United States, the United Nations. You do think this one's different?
I think it probably is different. I think it's different for a variety of reasons. One reason is that the chance of a clear-cut victory, if there ever was one, certainly has gone. The UAE, which supported the Saudi coalition, has essentially pulled out. The Saudis clearly want to move out. They haven't said this publicly, but that's quite clear of their intention. The Houthis, they're not going anywhere. I mean, they can't lose. They can't essentially be defeated. That's where they are. It's how much territory they still possess, how much power they still possess. So I think we've reached a point, helped by the ceasefires last year, helped by the confidence-building measures that have created a framework now that is much more conducive to a success in these sorts of talks.
You have the Saudis supporting the government. The Houthi rebels, we know, are supported by Iran. Now, Iran and Saudi Arabia had their own little peace deal a month ago when they agreed to re-establish diplomatic relations. Is that also an influencing factor?
I think very much on this aspect of what's happening. And to be honest, it's a big peace deal. I mean, the growing hostility between the Saudis and Iranians already defined the region for years now. And there was many times it looked like it was getting out of hand. So this has been a proxy war to an extent. I mean, one can overstate that, but Iran definitely has help the Houthis. And the Saudis, of course, have been 100% the major backers behind the government.
We've talked exclusively here about the battle between the government, the officially international recognised government, and the Houthis. But I know that this conflict has seen other parties. Is there a danger that the violence could continue with them?
The violence, certainly the kind of chaotic sense, the plight that Yemen was in long before this war erupted, those divisions, those conflicts are still very much there between different parts of a country, between different factions. Al-Qaeda has a role. I mean, you could say that the war, the face-off between the Houthis and the Saudi coalition, has been the top layer of what's been going on all this time. But underneath, those other layers remain.
Sebastian Usher. As we record this podcast, charities operating in the Mediterranean Sea have raised an alert for some 400 people on a boulder boat, which they say is adrift and taking on water. One group, Alarm Phone, says the vessel left Tobruk in eastern Libya and is currently in a search and rescue area covered by Malta. Danny Eberhardt reports.
Alarm Phone says it's been speaking to the migrants on board via an Arabic translator. They reported to have told it the captain had left the boat and no one could get it started. The charity is concerned for their safety. One of those on board is said to be a pregnant woman. A separate charity, Sea-Watch, has published a photo of the badly overcrowded fishing vessel, which was located by one of its planes. It says the boat is at serious risk of capsizing, with the weather due to worsen. Sea-Watch says two merchant ships in the area have been warned off trying to mount a rescue, allegedly by the Maltese authorities. Malta has been asked to comment.
Danny Eberhardt. Women in Iran's capital have been prevented from getting on the underground train network if they don't cover their hair and wear what's considered modest clothing. Footage aired on Iranian television news shows security officials stopping those in Tehran who aren't wearing the hijab and other Islamic dress, giving them a choice, either to put it on or not travel. The crackdown on public transport follows an announcement that CCTV footage would be used to identify women out in public not wearing Islamic dress. Many women have been flouting the law since a young Kurdish woman was arrested last year because of the dress code. Mahsa Amini then died in custody. I spoke to Parham Khobad from the BBC's Persian service about the new measures.
They're going to use CCTVs across the country, even those for traffic, to find women who are not observing hijab and find those women and also send them to court. The other thing is that they're asking shopkeepers not to give service to women who are not wearing hijab. Otherwise, their shop will be shut down. And also today, Iranian state TV showed footage that you see a man who is present at an underground station, and he bars women from taking the tube and entering the station, those who are not wearing the hijab.
This does sound like a very different approach to the more confrontational way they were dealing with it by beating, arresting women. Why do you think this change of tone, even if what they're enforcing is the same?
Because when they confront Iranian women, the videos of that usually go viral. It appears, it surfaces on social media, and that is costly for them. They fear another round of protests. And the government is in a difficult position because they don't know how to handle hundreds of thousands of women across the country who are walking about the streets without a job.
I've also seen there Iran saying it's going to introduce a new law that's designed to protect women. What could you tell us about that?
So this was a bill proposed 12 years ago, and they just passed that, but it hasn't turned into a law yet because there is a watchdog that monitors all the bills that are passed. It's yet to be approved. But it's really not a game changer in this scenario, because it says that women who are harassed by their husbands can go to the court, and if they are allowed, they can leave the country. So it's not like it's heaven for women in Iran right now. Women still need the permission from their husband in order to obtain passport and in order to leave the country.
Parham Gobad. South Korea's presidential office says it will hold discussions with the United States after reports surfaced that U.S. intelligence agencies had interrupted South Korean communications on whether to sell weapons to Washington. Here's Celia Hatton.
Papers leaked from the Pentagon appear to reveal that late last year, Seoul was concerned artillery shells sold to the U.S. would end up in Ukraine, violating South Korea's policy against supplying lethal aid. The papers indicate these internal conversations were accessed through signals intelligence, revealing that Washington had likely been spying on one of its main allies in Asia. U.S. officials have confirmed the leaked papers are legitimate, although at least one of the documents appears to have been modified from the original, raising questions about their authenticity.
Celia Hatton. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has said the number of wild tigers in the country has almost doubled in the past two decades, part of a longer-running conservation project.
Project Tiger has completed 50 years. Its success is not only a subject of pride for India, but for the entire world. We do not believe in conflict between ecology and economy, but give importance to their coexistence.
Mr. Modi was announcing the latest tiger census data at a ceremony in the southern state of Karnataka, as Lipika Pelham reports.
Sporting camouflage clothing and a matching hat, Mr. Modi joined a 20-kilometre safari at the popular Bandipur Tiger Reserve. Project Tiger began in 1973 when India's tigers were fast going extinct through habitat loss, hunting sport and poaching. The country's 3,000 tigers now account for 75% of the world's wild population. But while Mr. Modi boasts of the success story, India's Adivasi or indigenous groups say the government's conservation policy uprooted communities that had lived in the forests for millennia.
Lipika Pelham. Still to come, two British Israeli sisters shot dead in the occupied West Bank on Friday have been buried. A father paying tribute to his daughters.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
The cyber criminal group.
It was the Lazarus group again.
These are smart guys.
The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
We're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. I'm Paul Moss. Now, another story of a family torn apart by the war in Ukraine. When Russian forces occupied the city of Mariupol last May, Alexandra Stolia and her daughter Irina Navalna left their shattered streets. But in August, Irina went back to check on her grandmother and to pick up some of their possessions. She was detained by Russian forces, and she since appeared on Russian television, allegedly confessing that she planned to blow up a polling station during a referendum in the occupied areas of eastern Ukraine. Lise Doucet spoke to Irina's mother, Alexandra.
There were 20 people in a cell that was made for 10 people. Still, they sleep two people in one bed and they're not allowed to sit. They have to stand for 16 hours. They don't have any drinking water. They don't have any warm water. They have to warm it with their bodies. Irina's grandma brings water every time she visits the prison. She's normally not allowed to see her. Just visit 25 liters of water. We know that only half of that amount is delivered to Irina, and they're not allowed to make any loud noises. And for each loud noise, they've been punished.
Were you worried when your daughter Irina first said she wanted to go back to Mariupol to see her grandmother?
Of course, I tried to persuade her not to go, but she's a grown-up. She was convinced she wouldn't have any problems.
Do you know what happened to her once she got there?
She was there for a month. Nothing bad happened. But on 27th of September, we know that she was arrested, and we don't know how she was arrested.
And then there was a video on the Novosti agency of Irina confessing. Did you see that? And what did you think?
I saw this video. This video showed them questioning her. And yes, she confessed that she was trying to blow up a polling station for the referendum.
Did you have any information that your daughter had been in any way involved in political activities?
I completely cannot imagine her being involved in any political activities. In my view, she's just a very pure child with pure heart, very creative person. And as I know, she never, ever been involved in anything like that.
So why do you think they would have picked up your daughter? There was some commentary that because her last name is Navalna, which is the female version in Ukrainian of Navalny, the same name as the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny, that maybe that made them suspicious. What do you think?
I'm almost convinced that she was arrested just because her name is Navalna. Also, she had tattoos on her body. They normally search people. I'm sure they just wanted to arrest her to report to their higher officers that they're doing their job well.
What did she say in this latest video that you see as being so incredible?
The video was released today at 6 o'clock. I didn't have chance to watch it properly, but I had a quick look. She says the same thing as she says in the earlier videos, but I remember she says, I wouldn't speak without my lawyer. And then they take her away and she comes back all in tears. And she said to her grandma, they badly beaten her with the sticks on her head.
Oleksandra Stolya speaking to the BBC's Lise Doucette. Thousands of worshippers have held tent celebrations in Jerusalem, the Jewish holiday of Passover, coinciding with the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. They've been observed at a time of escalating violence in Israel's conflict with the Palestinians, much of it focused on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the neighbouring Jewish holy site, the Western Wall. Israel has also been exchanging fire with neighbouring countries, as our Middle East correspondent Yelan Nell reports.
Defiantly, Palestinian Muslims fasting for Ramadan lined up to pray in the courtyard of Al-Aqsa Mosque this morning, while heavily armed Israeli police escorted hundreds of Jewish visitors around the holy site, also known as Temple Mount. Overnight, Palestinians had barricaded themselves in the mosque, raising fears that there could be a repetition of last week's violent scenes when Israeli officers raided the prayer hall. Instead, there was only a tense standoff. Later, at the Western Wall, which lies below, thousands of Jewish worshippers joined Passover prayers. And bells rang out for Easter Sunday in the nearby Holy Sepulchre Church. The rare occurrence of the overlapping religious holidays here has led to an increase in unrest. There was regional condemnation of Israel's handling of recent events at Al-Aqsa, where police said they were forced to act against masked agitators. In response, rockets blamed on Palestinian militants were fired into Israel from both the Gaza Strip and southern Lebanon. And last night saw a new front opening up, with six rockets fired from Syria at Israeli-controlled territory. Israel says its warplanes have hit Syrian military targets in response.
Yelan now. Even before this week's escalation, there were increasing tensions in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have carried out raids on Palestinian villages. Palestinians have struck back. And on Friday, two young British Israeli sisters were killed in a suspected Palestinian attack. Maya and Rina D were shot in their car as they set off on holiday from the settlement where they live. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson was at their funeral service in Kfar Etzion.
They brought in the bodies, so slight for the weight of grief here. Maya and Rina, wrapped in cloth embroidered with the Star of David, were laid in front of neighbours, family and Rina's wailing school friends. Their father, Rabbi Leo D, bent low over their bodies, the pain on his face hidden for a moment in a last embrace with his daughters, before addressing the crowd.
Today the Jewish people have proven that we are one. We are united, Alecha. But the simple, quiet family in the front is devastated. The whole country hurts. And when the family in Jerusalem is devastated, the whole country hurts.
Maya was 20 years old when she died. Rina was 15. Their mother, still unconscious in hospital, doesn't even know yet that they're dead. They were travelling from their West Bank settlement to the Sea of Galilee for a family holiday this week when their Israeli car came under fire. Among the mourners today, Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, a hard-right leader who was once a member of a banned extremist group. Personal loss here can quickly become political. Funerals are the fingerprints of this conflict, mapping the land with the graves of Israelis and Palestinians.
Lucy Williamson. On Sunday, Pope Francis made his first major public appearance since being released from hospital, delivering his annual Easter message to crowds gathered in the Vatican. As in previous years, he emphasised conflicts around the world, expressing his hope for peace in Haiti, Lebanon and Myanmar. Ukraine got a special mention, as did the rising tide of violence in Israel and the Palestinian territories, as Aline McBull reports from Rome.
Outside on a stunning Easter morning, with people packed in and around St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis led Mass. All eyes had been on his health. There had been moments during Holy Week when the Pope had appeared somewhat tired, weak and breathless, following that spell in hospital with bronchitis. For the first time, he even sat out one event. But after Easter Mass, as he was driven through the crowds in his open-top vehicle, he seemed energised, waving to those who'd come here from near and far.
He looked in really good health. You know, the crowd, I'm sure, were encouraging him along, but he looked very healthy. You know, it was great to see him in fine spirits.
I was very worried when he was in hospital, and I kept informed because he's so special. And to see him here, you realise how strong he is.
The Pope's final duty of this, the toughest of weeks in his calendar, was to appear on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica before an estimated 100,000 people to deliver his blessing. In it, he talked of his deep concern over recent events in the Middle East, praying this Easter for peace in the holy city of Jerusalem and beyond.
Aline McBull. At least four people have died in an avalanche in the French Alps, and around 13 people have been injured. It happened at the Amanchetta Glacier near Mont Blanc. The French President, Emmanuel Macron, expressed his condolences to the families of those who fled. Phoebe Hobson reports.
It's thought to be the deadliest avalanche of the season. Video captured from a bystander shows a large area of billowing white snow racing down the steep mountain face. Authorities say at least four people have died, among them two experienced mountain guides. Two people are still missing. Jean-Luc Martel, the deputy mayor of Les Contamines-Montjoie, paid tribute to the guides.
On pleure. Une grande tristesse.
We cry. It's a great sadness for all us mountaineers, for all friends of the region. These were people we knew. All our thoughts are with their families.
No avalanche warning was given, and it's thought that those caught up in the avalanche were skiing off-piste. A local official said a combination of warm weather and wind probably caused a slab of snow to detach from the top of the mountain at around 11:30 in the morning. The search for those missing has stopped for the night, but will start again early on Monday, despite warnings that further avalanches cannot be ruled out.
Phoebe Hobson. It's nearly 80 years since a young man stood up in a courtroom in the German city of Nuremberg and began the prosecution of several dozen leading war criminals. Ben Ferenc has just died at the age of 103, but was only 27 years old when he was given the task at Nuremberg. He'd seen for himself the results of the Nazis' genocide, entering several liberated concentration camps as a member of the US Army. And in later life, Ferenc campaigned to see human rights abuses elsewhere, both recognised and punished. Richard Hamilton looks back at a remarkable life.
Ben Ferenc was born in Transylvania, now part of Romania, in 1920. His family emigrated to the US when he was a baby to escape anti-Semitism, and they settled in New York. His father was a shoemaker and a janitor. Ben was highly intelligent and won a scholarship to Harvard Law School. In 1943, he joined the army and took part in the Allied landings. He became a sergeant and joined a team investigating Nazi war crimes. In a BBC interview in 2017, he recalled entering the Buchenwald death camp.
Dead bodies lying all on the ground. You can't tell if they're dead or alive. Skeletons dressed in just rags. Everybody's running in different directions. The SS are trying to run out. A pile of rubbish the size of this room. Inmates groveling like rats for a bite of food and just picking out garbage and sticking it into their mouths. The smell of foul flesh burning, stacks of human bodies looking like bones, stacked one on top of the other, while they just shoveled into the crematorium and then turned into ashes, and the fat is used for making soap, and the ashes are used as fertilizer. And when I wrote somewhere that I had peered into hell, I think hell would be paradise compared to what I saw.
After the war, Ben Ferenc was asked to prosecute Nazis at the Nuremberg trials.
Attention! Tribunal!
Judges from Britain, America, Russia and France assemble in Nuremberg's courthouse. Empowered to impose sentence of death, or such punishment as it may consider just, the tribunal sits in judgment upon 20 leaders of the Nazi Party.
He prosecuted members of the Einsatzgruppen, mobile death squads that operated in Eastern Europe, murdering more than 1 million people. After the trials, Ben Ferenc, who was fluent in 6 languages, remained in West Germany to help Jewish groups obtain reparations. In his later years, he became a professor of international law and campaigned for an international criminal court to prosecute war crimes. He gave this assessment of what he had learned in a life dedicated to fighting injustice.
These are not crimes committed by devils with horns. These are committed by educated, well-intentioned, patriotic people. But we have to change the hearts and minds of people. So this re-education of the human spirit and the human mind on a worldwide basis is a task before us, and we are doing it. And I say, law is always better than war, and that's my firm conviction. No matter if you get a bad decision, law will always be better than war, which is murderous and terrible. And the 3 ways of preventing it is 1, never give up, 2, never give up, 3, and then I hear the echo from the audience, never give up.
In 2002, the ICC was finally established in The Hague, although its effectiveness has been limited as several major countries, including the United States, have refused to take part. Paying tribute, the US Holocaust Museum said the world had lost a leader in the quest for justice for victims of genocide.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy, and the producer was Alison Davies. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.